The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading from The Week magazine, dated August 10th, 2012. Thanks so much for joining me today. We begin with the main story section. Our first article is entitled, Romney's Mixed Reception Abroad. What happened? Mitt Romney attempted to build his foreign policy credentials this past week with a six-day trip abroad in which he celebrated the special relationship with Britain on the eve of the Olympic Games, affirmed Poland's strong ties to the U.S., and committed himself to the security of Israel. But the presumptive Republican presidential nominee clouded his message with a series of verbal miscues as he offended the British and outraged Palestinians. In Israel, Romney pledged strong support for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's hawkish stance on Iran, declaring that any and all measures should be used to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons. He stirred controversy when he stated that the large economic disparity between Israel and the Palestinians could be explained by culture and the hand of providence. Palestinian official Saeb Erekat called that a racist statement, saying it was the Israeli occupation that's causing Palestinian poverty. In the United Kingdom, Romney upset his hosts by casting doubt on London's preparation for the Olympic Games, saying security problems were disconcerting. A furious British media mocked Romney as Mitt the Twit, while Prime Minister David Cameron shot back, "Of course it's easier if you hold an Olympic Games in the middle of nowhere," a reference to Romney's management of the Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City in 2002. What the editorial said, Republicans need to revoke Romney's passport, said the Newark, New Jersey Star-Ledger. First, he dissed the Brits at their proudest moment. Then he threatened the peace process in Israel by implying that the Palestinians were culturally inferior to the Israelis and calling Jerusalem, which must be divided if there's any hope of peace, the capital of Israel. How can such a tone-deaf buffoon ever represent the U.S. as president? Yes, Romney got off on the wrong foot in Britain, said the Wall Street Journal, but the trip was hardly a fiasco. His tough talk on Iran was welcomed, as was his praise of Israel's culture of innovation. He also exposed how Obama has backpedaled and pivoted away from our key allies, said the New York Post, embracing Israel, endorsing abiding American-British unity, and standing strong with the Poles in their opposition to Russian ambitions, drew a stark contrast with Obama's limp leadership. Now here's what the columnist said. Romney's visit to Israel perfectly illustrated much of what is wrong with the U.S.-Israel relationship today, said Thomas Friedman in the New York Times. Like other Republicans, he pandered to hardliners like Netanyahu and super PAC donor Sheldon Adelson, telling them exactly what they wanted to hear while blatantly ignoring the other side. A true ally of Israel would commit to finding a two-state solution and prevent Israel from becoming an apartheid pariah state. But Romney didn't rule out future agreements with the Palestinians, said Rich Lowry in the NationalReview.com. All he did was speak the truth, said the Israelis' westernized culture of entrepreneurship has helped them thrive. It was a message of economic freedom that he also spoke about in post-communist Poland, said Kathleen Parker in the Washington Post. While the nation's gaffe-seekers were enjoying a few moments of snark, Romney articulated on this trip why free markets, individual liberty, and religious freedom are the foundations of any enlightened functioning society. No wonder that Romney's surrogates are trying to spin this disastrous trip with such frantic intensity, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. What he revealed abroad was not just that he's a diplomatic klutz, but that he has a dangerously simplistic and arrogant worldview. Romney is very much the same insular plutocrat who made a fortune in a venture capital firm, assessing new assets with cookie-cutter formulas, and then bullying them into serving his own interests. Is he presidential material? Get serious. In their hearts, even Romney's supporters must know he failed to present himself as an unflappable potential world leader, said Scott Conroy in RealClearPolitics.com. But Romney's speeches did satisfy the Republican base. And as the focus of the race now returns to the economy, Romney's foreign blunders will soon be far in the rearview mirrors of swing voters. Our second article today from the Week magazine's main story section is entitled Assad's Assault on Aleppo. Syrian fighter jets, tanks, and artillery pounded rebel-held neighborhoods in the commercial hub of Aleppo this past week as AIDS workers warned of an impending humanitarian disaster in this sprawling city of 3 million people. The United Nations said that more than 200,000 residents had fled the city, which has become the focal point of the 18-month uprising against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Those who remained were struggling to meet their basic needs. There is no water or electricity in many areas, said Abu Ra'ed, an activist in Aleppo. Despite being outgunned, rebels said they had seized several regime bases inside Aleppo and claimed that a growing number of government troops were defecting. They can shell us from afar with tanks and helicopters, said rebel commander Colonel Abdel Jabbar al-Qadaki, but inside their morale is zero. Assad is now president in name only, said David Blair in the London Telegraph, by launching a full-scale assault on the country's largest city, until recently a regime stronghold, the dictator has proved that he's clinging to power by force alone. Of course, the core of his security forces can still be counted on to obey orders and defeat the rebels in pitched battles, but the clock is clearly ticking. He might hold on for a few months, but he cannot win. Neither can the rebels, said John Allen Gay in nationalinterest.org. If the Assad regime loses Aleppo and Damascus, it will simply withdraw its forces to the homelands of the country's Alawite and Christian minorities. These homelands, centered on the cities of Tartus in the south and Latakia in the north, are a natural fortress defended by the soaring mountains of the Jabal and Nusayriya range. The war will not be over. The balance will merely have shifted. And the U.S. might not like Damascus's new rulers, said Matt Gurney in the National Post in Canada. While the West has been loath to cozy up to the rebels, Saudi Arabian Islamists have been supplying the opposition's more extreme elements with guns and money. That firepower has given the radicals more clout in the rebellion, pushing secular rebels to the sidelines. Ironically, this lends credence to Assad's claim that the uprising was driven by jihadists and by al-Qaeda. That wasn't true before, but if current trends continue, it might become true soon enough. The next article, back at home, tepid economic growth. A new economic report showed the U.S. recovery losing its momentum, indicating that the unemployment rate will remain high right up to the November election. The rate of economic growth between April and June slowed to an anemic 1.5%, below the 2% gain reported in the first quarter of the year, and economists say they do not expect growth to increase substantially in the next few months. Faltering consumer spending and a contracting public sector serve as a major drag. The U.S. economy is barely growing, said economic analyst Dan Greenhouse. It's no wonder the unemployment rate cannot move lower. It's important to understand how unusual this kind of weak recovery is, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Historically, deep recessions have been followed up by vigorous recoveries, as there is more lost ground to make up. Obama's economic policies have clearly failed. Voters may not blame Obama for the Great Recession, said the Washington Examiner, but this dismissal recovery, this dismal recovery has occurred on his watch, and Americans have no confidence whatsoever in his ability to right the ship. He's in real danger of losing in November. Don't be so sure of that, said Jonathan Bernstein in thewashingtonpost.com. The economy isn't booming, but we're still seeing slow but positive growth. That leaves the election a toss-up, with Obama a bit more likely to win than to lose. The obsession with the latest gross domestic product and unemployment numbers is ultimately misleading, said Zachary Carabel in the dailybeast.com. These statistics are essentially guesstimates. GDP growth in the last quarter of 2011 was just revised upward to 4% from 3%, and that had been reported at the time. And had that been reported at the time, it might well have changed the entire tenor of our public debate. To get the economy moving again, we need consumer and business confidence, and fetishizing simplistic statistics isn't helping. Now we'll turn to the controversy of the week from the main story section in the Week magazine. It's entitled, Technology, Is It Making Addicts of Us All? The latest trend on the Internet, said Tracy McVeigh in The Observer in the UK, is to step away from the Internet, with smartphones, tablets, and other digital devices reshaping how people work, communicate, and spend their free time. Scientists and psychologists are starting to question what our reliance on these devices is doing to our minds. Next year, for the first time, Internet use disorder will be listed in the appendix of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, said Matt Richtel in the New York Times. Even in Silicon Valley, there's a growing concern that technology is taking over people's lives. We're done with this honeymoon phase, and now we're in a phase that says, wow, what have we done, says tech guru Soren Gordhammer, who has organized an annual conference of Digerati called Wisdom 2.0 to explore the need for balance in a wired world. Companies like Google, Facebook, and Twitter are now teaching their own employees meditation and mindfulness and warning them of the dangers of the constant texting, tweeting, and web surfing. It's this basic cultural recognition that people have a pathological relationship with their devices, said Stanford University psychologist Kelly McGonigal, who consults with tech company executives. People feel just addicted, not just addicted, but also trapped. Don't blame the gadgets, said Alexis Madrigal in TheAtlantic.com. It's not your smartphone's fault that you compulsively check your email, at a stoplight, at the dinner table, in bed. It's mostly the fault of our employers, who now expect workers to be available 24/7. We can also blame the strange American political and cultural systems that make us feel guilty about taking any time off and obligated to meet the growing demand for nonstop productivity. People have iPhones in Britain and Germany, too, yet Americans now put an average of 122 more hours per year than Brits and 378 hours, nearly 10 weeks more than the Germans. Beware, we're already paying a steep price for our digital obsession, said Tony Dokopil in Newsweek. Research shows that constant use of these devices is actually rewiring the physical structure of people's brains. Every time your phone, tablet, or computer pings with a new text, tweet, or email, it triggers a sense of expectation, and the reward centers in your brain receive a pleasurable squirt of dopamine. Over time, a brain habituated to these quick fixes shrinks the structures used for concentration, empathy, and impulse control, while growing new neurons receptive to speedy processing and instant gratification. Brain scans of Internet addicts, defined as anyone online more than 38 hours a week, can resemble those of cocaine addicts and alcoholics. Symptoms of Internet addiction can range from depression to acute psychosis. The Internet, in other words, is driving us mad. I know of a good treatment, if not a cure, said Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times. It's called nature. When we get into the great outdoors, the illusion of control that technology provides disappears, and we are deflated, humbled, and awed all at once. In the vast natural cathedral, we are reminded of a world much larger than ourselves, one that predates us, will outlive us, and at whose mercy we exist. To escape our post-industrial self-absorption, we all need to leave our iPhones at home at least once a week and go take a walk in the woods. Your devices will be waiting when you get back, and you'll be a bit saner when you rejoin the endless conversation. And now from the Week magazine for this week, we will turn to the popular column, A Good Week For and A Bad Week For. It was a good week for Michael Phelps after the American swimmer became the most decorated Olympian of all time by winning his 19th medal that was last week at the London Olympic Games. Over three games, Phelps has won 15 golds, two silvers, and two bronzes. It was a good week for the U.S. women's gymnastics team, which was so dominant on its way to winning a gold medal that many experts said it was the best team gymnastics performance ever. They're just so far ahead of anyone else, British gymnast Rebecca Tunney said. And it was a good week for reinventing yourself after hip-hop artist Snoop Dogg had a spiritual awakening in Jamaica and announced that he was now a Rastafarian reggae artist named Snoop Lion. I just didn't have my third eye open, but it's wide open right now, said Lion. It was a bad week for the Olympic flame. After technicians extinguished the flame in order to move it to another part of the stadium, according to Olympic tradition, the flame is supposed to remain lit for the entirety of the games. It was a bad week for Olympic fever after a Londoner vacationing in France decided to attempt to swim to New York City, saying he was off to carry the Olympic spirit across the Atlantic. He had to be rescued by lifeguards about 300 yards into his 3,600-mile journey. And it was a bad week for yelling at your effing computer after a survey by CareerBuilder.com found that 57% of employers said they'd be less likely to promote someone who curses, and 64% think less of an employee who habitually swears. Now we'll turn to the People's section of the Week magazine for this week. Our first article is entitled, John's Clean Break. Elton John is amazed he's still alive, said Sarah Bosley in The Guardian. For decades, he lived the wild rock star life, snorting vast amounts of cocaine and sleeping around without using condoms. I should be dead, 6 foot under in a wooden box, says the singer. I should have contracted HIV in the 1980s and died in the 90s, just like Freddie Mercury, just like Rock Hudson. Every day I wonder, how did I survive? He thinks his crazed behavior was driven by a desire to be popular. I was never in the gang at school, so when I saw someone doing drugs, I thought, oh, maybe I can do that and I will be with the big boys. Realizing that he had to change his ways or I was going to die, John cleaned up his act in the late 1980s and now leads a quieter family life with his husband David Furnish and their 18-month-old son Zachary. He doesn't miss his old existence. I know when I come off stage, I'm going to be happy. I can go to bed. I don't have to stay up all night doing drugs. I'm going to get up in the morning and see my little boy and see my partner. We have a life. Next, from the people section, the reluctant lama. Ashoka Mukpo never wanted to be a reincarnated Buddhist master, said Joseph Hooper in details. Mukpo was brought up in Colorado by his British mother and her Tibetan husband, Chogyam Trungpa, the founder of a hippified Buddhist movement. Mukpo wasn't Trungpa's child. His mother became pregnant after a fling with a Trungpa's physician, but the holy man raised him as his son. And when he was 8 years old, Trungpa declared that his stepson was the reincarnation of the great Tibetan Lama Kamyan Rinpoche. Growing up, Mukpo thought this meant he was marked for great things, but also made him feel like a freak. When you're 15, you can't say, "Dude, I'm a reincarnated spiritual master from the hills of Tibet," without making people think that you're just plain weird. He visited Tibet at age 22 and was treated like a saint. "I had old ladies coming up to me and crying. Someone put a sick baby in my face and asked me to blow on it. I did. I'm not going to be the guy who says this whole thing doesn't make sense for me. Sorry." Mukpo, who is 31 years old now, eventually stepped off the spiritual path and now works as a human rights campaigner. The Tibetan community hasn't pressured him to resume his old role. "It's easy for them to write me off. I'm the white guy." And the next article from the People section is entitled, "Renner's Other Job." "Jeremy Renner is quite the handyman," said Chris Jones in Esquire magazine. When the Avengers star signed his first big movie contract in 2002, he used the money to buy a rundown Los Angeles house with fellow actor Christopher Winters. "I hated paying rent," the actor says. "It was just money going out the window. They remodeled the house for fun, but when it sold for a $240,000 profit, they realized they could turn their hobby into a business." The pair started buying promising properties and often lived in the gutted houses, without plumbing or power, to save a few dollars. "I can tell you every Starbucks that had a bathroom around Los Angeles," Renner says. His latest project is an 11-bedroom mansion that he bought at an IRS auction and plans to sell for at least $25 million. Renner thinks that his sideline in construction has taught him the skills he needs to sustain a long career in Hollywood. "Building a house is like producing a movie. There's no right way to do it, but a lot of wrong ways. You have to be flexible and creative. You have to move fast, be prepared, or it quickly becomes costly. It certainly affected how I approach life." Now, from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the briefing section for this week. It is entitled, "When the U.S. Invaded Canada." 2 centuries ago, the U.S. declared war on Britain. Why did we fight the War of 1812? And who really won? Who started the war? The United States was the first to declare war, though after repeated British provocations. At the time, the Napoleonic Wars were raging across Europe, and the Royal Navy had taken to seizing American sailors at sea and press-ganging them into their undermanned fleet. Already infuriated by British attempts to prevent the U.S. from trading with France, President James Madison and the so-called War Hawks in Congress urged the country to go to war and defend its recently won independence. But the June 1812 vote to go to war only narrowly passed the House and the Senate, and critics condemned Mr. Madison's war as a foolhardy adventure, motivated less by crimes at sea than by a lust for land. Indeed, the American offensive began with a land invasion of Canada. Why invade Canada? It was the closest British colony, but Madison also had political reasons for targeting America's northern neighbor. His Democratic-Republican Party drew much of its support from the rural South and what was then the American West, the territory stretching up the Mississippi Basin to the Great Lakes. Frontier inhabitants were eager to strike at the British in Canada because they suspected them of arming Native American tribes that were standing in the way of America's westward expansion. Many Americans also believed that the invasion would be a cakewalk and that ordinary Canadians were keen to shake off their British overlords. The acquisition of Canada, predicted former President Thomas Jefferson, will be a mere matter of marching. How did the invasion go? Terribly. At the outbreak of hostilities, the U.S. Army was a poorly equipped force of fewer than 7,000 men. Many of them complete amateurs with virtually no training or discipline, said historian Alan Taylor. It didn't help that the initial offensive was led by the aging General William Hull, later damned by a subordinate as an imbecile. After an abortive foray across the Detroit River into Canada, Hull fell for a bogus report that a vast Indian war party was heading his way and surrendered his 2,500 troops to a much smaller force. With the war only a few months old, the entire Michigan Territory had fallen into British lands, or rather British hands. Did the U.S. have any victories? Yes, strangely enough, at sea. In 1812 and 1813, the tiny U.S. Navy bested the supposedly invincible British fleet in a series of duels on the Great Lakes and in the Atlantic. It is a cruel mortification to be beaten by these second-hand Englishmen upon our own element, a British minister declared. But in 1814, Britain decided to teach the upstarts a lesson and launched a counteroffensive along the mid-Atlantic coast, overwhelming small American gunboats. Some 4,000 Royal Marines marched into Washington, which American officials had abandoned so hastily that an uneaten banquet for 40 was left laid out in the White House. The Marines downed the food and wine before torching the White House and the Capitol building as well, vengeance for the earlier American ransacking of York, which is now Toronto. But the British offensive stalled outside Baltimore, where a small American garrison at Fort McHenry withstood a 25-hour naval bombardment, a sight that inspired a young lawyer, Francis Scott Key, to scribble out the words to the Star-Spangled Banner on the back of a letter. How did the war end? It was essentially a stalemate. By late 1814, the U.S. government was also almost bankrupt because of the expense of the conflict, while Britain wanted to end what it regarded as a sideshow to the larger war against Napoleon. So on Christmas Eve, 1814, the two sides signed a peace treaty in Ghent, which is now Belgium, that restored the pre-war borders of the U.S. and Canada, without even mentioning the maritime issues that had started the conflict. But news of the peace deal didn't reach the 5,000 British troops gathered outside New Orleans in time. They attacked the city on January 8, 1815, but were easily repulsed by some 4,000 defenders led by Major General Andrew Jackson. By the end of the day, the British had lost 291 men, the Americans only 13. The military triumph restored U.S. pride, and Jackson was hailed as a national hero. What was the legacy of the War of 1812? Everyone declared victory. Canadians could celebrate the fact that they had repelled an invasion, an achievement that united them in a new sense of nationhood. We were refugees, American loyalists, British soldiers, First Nations, a mixed bag of people who realized they had a common land to defend, said Tom Sololoski, a Canadian artist who organized a recent 1812 art exhibit in Toronto. For America, meanwhile, the late victory at the Battle of New Orleans was a major morale booster. The war had become a glorious redeclaration of independence, said historian James Lundberg. Its missteps were forgotten, and a new generation of national heroes was born, Andrew Jackson first among them. The only real losers were Native Americans, ravaged by the conflict and abandoned by their British allies. The tribes along the frontier would soon be outnumbered and pushed aside by a wave of American settlers. And the footnote to this briefing column is called "The Americans Are Coming." The War of 1812 produced its own Paul Revere, except this folk hero was a woman who served the British. On the evening of June 21, 1813, Laura Secord overheard American officers billeted at her home in Queenston, Ontario, plotting a raid on a nearby British outpost. The 37-year-old mother of five hiked for 18 hours through mosquito-infested swamps and forests to reach the Redcoats' camp. Armed with her information, the British and their Indian allies were able to ambush the American force, capturing 462 soldiers. Secord received no recognition or compensation for her part in the victory until 1860, when the Prince of Wales stopped in Queenston to pay tribute to the veterans of 1812. Told of Secord's heroism, he awarded the then 85-year-old 100 pounds as a thank you for her bravery. And you're listening to our reading of the Week magazine today from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks so much for joining me today. We'll now turn to the best columns in the U.S. for this past week. Our first column is called "Hypocrisy at the Olympics" by Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. For months, relatives of the six Israeli athletes murdered by terrorists in 1972 made a simple request of the International Olympic Committee, said Jonathan Tobin. They asked that on the 40th anniversary of the most horrific day in Olympic history, the opening ceremony include a moment of silence to honor the memories of the dead. The Olympic organizers refused, insisting there wasn't time and claiming that such a remembrance would be a political intrusion, inappropriate to the joyful spirit of the ceremony. Now we know both excuses were fabrications. Last week, the opening ceremony included a nearly 6-minute-long choreographed commemoration of the July 7, 2005 London subway bombings. The 52 people who died that day at the hands of Islamist terrorists certainly deserve to be remembered. But why not also pay tribute to the Israeli athletes victimized by terrorists at the Olympics itself? There's only one logical conclusion to be drawn. For the Olympic Committee, like the United Nations and the rest of the international community, there are always different rules for Jews. And chief of those rules is that Jewish blood is cheap. The next column was entitled "Turning America into Iraq," and it was written by Andrew Jensen in the New York Times. If more Americans carried guns, we'd all be safer. That, said Andrew Jensen, is the rote response of Second Amendment absolutists every time some crazed gunman goes on a killing spree. But as a veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan, I seriously doubt that I or any other armed civilian could have stopped the madman who stepped into a movie theater in Aurora, Colorado, armed with a semi-automatic rifle with a 100-round magazine and three other guns. Would I, as a trained rifleman, really be able to shoot a single person through a cloud of tear gas in a movie theater full of people screaming and running? Those who oppose all gun control prefer Americans to carry a gun at soccer practice, at church, at Batman movies, everywhere. It would feel almost like being in Iraq. The sane alternative is to limit the sale of weapons and magazines designed to inflict mass casualties. Is someone's right to buy an assault rifle worth having to carry a weapon yourself every moment you're outside your home for the rest of your life? The next column is entitled "Why Having Kids Is Worth It" by Amitai Adesone and CNN.com. Does having children make you stressed and miserable? Asked Amitai Edizoni. A recent spate of studies would suggest that it does, with research indicating that the nonstop hassle of changing diapers and caring for young children causes a happiness hit in marriage. But in asking whether having children makes you more happy or less happy, we need to define what we mean by happy. If it means catering to your own whims and needs throughout your entire adult life and squeezing as much pleasure out of life as possible, having children definitely is a downer. But such self-centered pleasure pales over time. As the father of five, I can attest that raising children from infancy to adulthood, while creating much irritation and heartache, produces a much deeper, more satisfying, and even unique form of contentment. Parenthood leaves you utterly enmeshed in lives outside your own, bonded by a deep mutuality that, despite its ups and downs, makes us into fully rounded and, yes, better human beings. My kids have given my life more meaning and purpose than my work or anything else, and now they've given me grandchildren to shower with love. What fun! And no diapers to be changed by me. And now we will flip through to the back of the Week magazine this week for the very popular column entitled The Last Word. This particular column this week is entitled A Casualty of Coal. After a mine disaster took their son, says Stephanie McCrumnan, the Quarles got a check from the company. Gary Quarles sat on the front porch of his trailer in Horse Creek Hollow, West Virginia, where he and his wife have lived for more than 30 years. The trailer had new paint. Two new white trucks were in the gravel driveway. Another trailer, 40 feet away, where his only son once lived, had a new roof and new furniture, although no one lives there now. Gary Wayne Quarles, 33, was one of 29 workers killed on April 5, 2010, in the Upper Big Branch mine disaster, the worst U.S. coal mining disaster in four decades. Massey Energy, which owned the mine, offered settlements to the families. Gary and his wife, Patty, called the $3 million offer a slap in the face. So they got a lawyer. Other families got lawyers. Earlier this year, the last of the wrongful death claims filed by the families against Massey and inherited by the company that brought it, Alpha Natural Resources, came down to 4 days of mediation. Offers were made and refused. Then Patty, her head pounding with a migraine, looked at a number, looked at her distraught husband, thought of her two grandchildren, and finally said, "Do it." With that and with other families agreeing to settlements whose terms remained confidential, millions of dollars had begun raining down on Appalachia, a bitter resolution for families who had hoped other forms of justice would also materialize. More than 2 years after an explosion that an independent panel blamed on a corporate culture that put the drive to produce coal above worker safety, no former high-ranking Massey executives have been criminally charged. No new federal mine safety legislation has passed, a matter Gary and others pressed in Washington recently, carrying poster-sized pictures of their lost sons, brothers, and husbands into the red-carpeted offices of senators and representatives. "This was my son, Gary Wayne," Gary said to lawyers over and over on a day that began with three antidepressants. "I called him my son, but he was a man, a real man." He paused to compose himself. "We are here for safety." But he and the others left without any new assurances on regulation. Now that they never have to worry about money again, Patty has retired from a part-time health care job. Gary retired from more than 20 years of coal mining, work he respected but never loved, especially when he worked for Massey. The company was frequently cited for federal safety violations, which it often contested. Its chief executive, Don Blankenship, resigned after the disaster with a payout reportedly worth at least $12 million. Production first, safety last. Haul the coal or haul your A-you-know-what, Gary said, reciting what he and other miners believed was the true Massey creed. He and his son had an easy rapport. If Gary Wayne ever swore at him, he can't remember, he says, and his son's life came to resemble his own in many respects. When Gary Wayne became a coal miner, he moved into a trailer next door. He got a truck, got married, had two kids, got divorced, and built a life around the rhythms of fatherhood, hunting seasons, and dinner with his parents. Gary leaned back in his front porch swing. The sun was out. I always wondered what it'd be like not having to work, he said. I love to hunt. I used to think when I'm retired, when the seasons come in, I can hunt every day. But see, me and Gary Wayne hunted. It ain't good. It ain't what I'd hoped it had been. Now when I make the trip, I cry going in. I cry in the tree stand, and I cry coming home. I never know when I might start crying. I don't really understand it. His wife said she only ever saw him cry one time before this. Now we cried remembering crying, and cried thinking about the night of the explosion when families gathered in a building and a woman from Massey holding a clipboard opened the door, keeping it ajar with her foot, a detail that still disturbs him. If I call your name, he recalled her saying, you are to report to the fire department to identify bodies. What kind of person says that? He cried last year when he and Patty finally got their son's autopsy report and read it in the parking lot of their lawyer's office. She wanted to know every single detail, to imagine it, to somehow be with her son in his last moment. He was reluctant to see Gary Wayne described so crudely. The decedent is identified by recognition of specific coal miner medallion and tracking number, it began. The decedent is received wearing heavily soot stained coveralls, heavy soot deposition on the anterior tongue surface, diffuse cherry red lividity, it continued, referring to a sign of carbon monoxide poisoning. The report noted that Gary Wayne had black lung disease and that the cause of death was smoke and soot inhalation, and it went on to describe his organs. His father was sorry to know how much his son's heart weighed. Gary got off the swing, and because he had all the time in the world to do anything he wanted, he got in his new truck and drove down the winding two-lane road, merging with the 5 p.m. traffic of miners heading to work or home. Everybody here knows everybody, he said, describing a world in which the coal mining business infuses everything. This guy here, he said, passing a house, me and him work together forever. This guy, he said, passing another, he's a mine inspector. When the explosion happened and I called, he didn't do nothing but cry. There were neighbors who went to high school with him or his son, kid who became mine bosses or safety officials, Massey executives or their in-laws, people who knew the blessings and curses of the business, people who felt empathy, but also degrees of guilt, and who lined up for three blocks for Gary Wayne's funeral. Gary drove past the house of his friend Goose, who survived the upper Big Branch explosion, and who said that when he sees Gary these days, he does not see a rich man, but a sad one. That was his boy. That was his pride and joy, he said. Gary drove past a local school. Massey paid for that, he said, and passed some little field ball fields there, little league ball fields. I was told Massey owned those, too. Past Upper Big Branch, which now has a sign that reads Coal River East. At one point in time, everyone loved Massey, Gary said, driving along. They gave money for ball teams, to restaurants. They owned you. A spokesman for Alpha said the company is committed to resolving problems it inherited when it bought Massey. Everyone wants to look forward, he said. It was a terrible thing that happened. I don't think anyone wants to keep reliving that. We've been able to do a lot since June of last year to sort of tie up some of those things and move forward. Gary pulled into Pine View Cemetery. Massey paid for this, he said, standing before his son's headstone. It was going to be $10,000 or more. It was way up there. Patty was going to use her debit card, but when we got home, there was a message saying Massey was going to pay for all of it. All the headstones, all the funerals, all of it. Massey paid for it. The whole time her husband was sitting outside or driving to the cemetery, Patty, who has an image of her son tattooed on her lower leg, had been sitting on an old leather couch. She had watched TV, taken a nap, then watched TV some more, then gone back to sleep. I know it's hard to believe, but I was a busy person before, she said, the next day sitting at the kitchen table. I loved housework, loved gardening. I've lost interest in everything. Now we can do whatever we want to do, but now we don't want to. She had thought about moving, she said, but she realized wherever I'm at, the same problem will be there. Also him, she said, pointing to her husband, sitting in the living room with a new pair of white headphones on, staring out the glass front door and listening to bluegrass songs by Ralph Stanley, including I Am a Man of Constant Sorrow, which he's known since he was a kid. He just listens to that music and cries, she said. I don't know if it gives him peace of mind. Me, I always like music, but I don't listen to it now. It makes me sad. Him, it doesn't matter how sad it is. They have been together since she was 14. Patty does not cry as much as her husband, not only because she knows that if she does, then he will fall apart. During a memorial service, the time Patty was crying, a Massey official touched her shoulder and said, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, over and over. More recently, before the settlement checks started arriving, a corporate lawyer, after explaining some legal details, leaned over to her and said, I'm so sorry, said Patty, just nodded. None of these stories made her feel better, and the financial settlement, perhaps the biggest sorry of all, brought its own burden. I wanted it over, she said. I wanted it over so bad. At the same time, she said, and now she was crying, this is your mom saying this is what your life's worth. Like your mom has sold you out. When the lawyer said $3 million, I was so mad I couldn't see straight. I wouldn't have settled. I wouldn't have settled for one red cent. And then she did it. She is legally prohibited from saying how much the settlement was, but she can say that when she finally agreed to it, she felt anything but better. Gary Wayne, well, this is what you was worth, she recalled thinking. He was our whole world, Patty said. He'd come to the door and say, Hey, Mom, I can almost still hear him. He was a 33-year-old man who never left home. His house was 40 feet away. It's unbearable to think about what's actually gone. When the check arrived from the coal company, she said, she and her husband felt relieved to have accomplished what they are certain their son wanted them to accomplish. They felt glad for his children, grateful to their lawyers, somehow humbled and vindicated. They felt like they'd reached the end of a necessary process. And with all of that, Gary felt as sad as ever. It won't never leave me, he said. Patty felt something else. Sick, she said. I felt sick. This article appeared in the Washington Post and was reprinted with permission. Now we turn to the Talking Point section of the Week magazine for some assorted news articles this week. Our first one is entitled, Chick-fil-A Culture War on a Bun. All of a sudden, biting into a fried chicken sandwich has become a political statement, said Bill Barrow in the Associated Press. Dan Cathy, an evangelical Christian who heads the fast food chain Chick-fil-A, set off the latest battle in the culture wars when he recently declared his company's opposition to same-sex marriage, saying that the U.S. was inviting God's judgment by legalizing gay unions. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel and Boston Mayor Thomas Menino quickly denounced Cathy's remarks and said his business wasn't welcome in their cities. Cathy has a First Amendment right to express his homophobia, said Tom Keene in the Boston Globe, but that doesn't make him immune from the consequences of those remarks. Emmanuel and Menino have clear grounds to suspect that Chick-fil-A would illegally discriminate against gay employees and customers, and that's more than enough reason to ban this bigoted business from their cities. But there's no evidence that Chick-fil-A has ever discriminated against gays, said Betsy Woodruff in NationalReview.com. Like every other successful business, Chick-fil-A happily sells its products to anyone who can fork over a few bucks. All Kathy has done is expressed his constitutionally protected religious beliefs, which were already well known, as the Bible Belt-based chain famously remained closed on Sundays. It should be the customer's decision whether or not to patronize his restaurants, not some self-appointed grand poobahs of political correctness like Emmanuel and Menino. Indeed, anyone cheering on these Pauls ought to imagine the jackboot on the other foot, said Eric Zorn in the Chicago Tribune. If we ban businesses simply because they offend our liberal ideals, it won't be long before reactionary public officials in some backwater town start kicking out firms that support Obamacare, abortion rights, or even marriage equality. Personally, I just wish I could eat my chicken sandwich in peace, said Alexandra Petri in WashingtonPost.com. It is bad enough to have to examine the caloric content of my food. Am I now also supposed to quiz restaurant owners about their stance on everything from gay rights to gun control before I eat in their establishments? If you make every meal into a major moral and political choice, you're going to be missing out on a lot of excellent sandwiches. Next thing you know, bacon will come out against women's rights. And then, where will I be? The next article is entitled, Olympics, the Backlash Against NBC. If NBC wanted people talking about London's Summer Olympics, said Robert Bianco in USA Today, consider that goal achieved. From the start of the opening ceremony, public grumbling over the network's handling of the games has grown into a roar. Though NBC's lightweight hosts and a melodramatic production have irked many viewers, the main focus of the anger is the network's insistence on tape delaying its coverage so that events that occur earlier in the day in London can be shown at night during prime time. That delay has led to comical paradoxes, said Heidi Moore in Guardian.co.uk. By the time NBC showed American swimmer Missy Franklin winning the gold, for example, the results had been on the Internet for hours, and NBC had just aired a promo for the next morning's Today show in which Franklin was asked what it was like to win your first gold medal. What NBC doesn't understand is that sports are news, and that in today's lightning-fast information culture, viewers want the news as it happens. True, but NBC paid $1.18 billion for the right to televise the game, said Megan Garber in TheAtlantic.com, and it won't get its money's worth without giving advertisers a massive primetime audience. For those who prefer to watch the games in real time, the network is streaming every event live at NBCOlympics.com, and some events on sister networks like MSNBC and CNBC. In essence, there are two Olympics, games of pure competition shown live, and the highly produced, heavily narrated, narrative, ad-filled, time-delayed product on NBC at night. The level of vitriol being directed at NBC is just bizarre, said Scott Pierce in the Salt Lake Tribune. There is no God-given right to see a sporting event on TV, and NBC is making a perfectly sensible business decision in tape-delaying its broadcasts. Based on the viewing figures so far, up 17% from the Beijing Games 4 years ago, the network would seem to be doing something right. I can forgive NBC's tape delay, said Emma Keller in Guardian.com.uk, but it's not its provincial pro-American chauvinism. The nightly telecast focuses almost entirely on American athletes, especially those with heartwarming personal stories that can be dragged out into gauzy mini-features. There are 10,500 athletes in London representing 204 countries, but if you watch NBC, you'd hardly know that there's more than one team competing in the Olympic Games. Now we'll take a look at a few shorter articles from The Week magazine this week as we reach the end of our program today. An Olympic gold medal is now just 1.34% gold. At current prices, a solid gold medal would cost about $25,000 to make, with a total bill of $40 million for the Games. The last time the Olympics handed out pure gold medals was at the 1912 Stockholm Games. About 723,000 foreign students were enrolled in U.S. universities in the 2010-2011 school year, a 32% jump from 2001, when security fears after 9/11 greatly reduced the number of foreign students. The number of Saudi Arabian students went from 1,000 in 2004 to 66,000. Partly as a result of President Obama's health care law, the country will have an estimated 62,900 fewer doctors than needed in 2015, when 30 million Americans will join the ranks of those with some form of insurance, said the Association of American Medical Colleges. The shortfall in doctors will more than double by 2025, as expanded coverage and the aging of baby boomers drives up the demand for care. Florida will soon become the first state in the nation with more than 1 million concealed weapons permits. About 80% of those with permits to carry weapons are men, and most are middle-aged. The state is issuing up to 15,000 new permits every single month. And our poll watch for this week, public views on gun laws remain largely unchanged by the recent massacre at the Colorado movie theater. 46% say it is more important to protect the right to own guns, while 47% say it is more important to control gun ownership. And 54% of Americans say they'd vote for a well-qualified atheist for president, the highest since Gallup began asking the question in 1958, when just 18% said they would vote for a non-believer. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We certainly hope that you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.